There we go.
Okay.
Right, cool. So today we've got a bit of a different style of guest. Do you want to introduce yourself to everyone?
Yeah, Dominic, I'm Douglas Ross. I'm the MP for Moray. I'm also MSP for the Highlands and Islands, and I lead the Scottish Conservatives.
Cool. So a quick disclaimer for everyone. I'm not endorsing any parties or anything. This is just, I'm at the age now in Scotland where I can vote. So I'm just trying to interview a few politicians to try and learn, and I thought I'd record it while I'm at it. That's the idea. So I'm not like saying go vote Tory or I should have the SNP on soon, go vote them. I'm just trying to learn. That's what it's about. So if Douglas Ross, if you say anything that people don't like, it's not my fault. That's what I'm saying. So anyway, how are you today?
I'm good. So I'm currently down in Westminster. My wife and kids have been showing me pictures of snow up in Moray, so it's cold down here. But no, it's a busy day down here in Westminster. Then I'm heading back up to Scotland later on in the week.
Cool. So whether people like you or not, they will admit you're very busy, right? So how do you fit it all in?
I mean, obviously my roles are different in a UK Parliament and the Scottish Parliament, but in some ways I think it's good. There are certain pieces of legislation that are debated both at Holyrood and at Westminster. It's not unique. I'm not the first person to have this dual mandate. In fact, when devolution started again in Scotland in 1999, there was a large number of Labour, SNP and Liberal Democrat MPs and MSPs who did the job at the same time. I've been very clear, I'm only going to do this until the next election. When I became leader of the party and therefore said I would stand for Holyrood, I'd only fairly recently, 6 months earlier, 8 months earlier, been re-elected as MP for Moray, and I wanted to serve out my time as MP for Moray, and at the next general election I'll step down and I'll only be an MSP then, but I'll continue to do the roles that I've been trying to do, with the both being an MP and an MSP, which is representing Moray, highlighting local cases and national issues on behalf of constituents.
Cool, yes, so fairly busy, and on the side you've got a bit of football.
I do, yes. We've met before. I think one of the charity matches my dad was playing in. I enjoy, you know, I sometimes get criticised for being a football referee as well. I think it's good that politicians have an outside interest. Quite often, the first question I get from school groups isn't about politics or policies. It's about which match I most enjoyed or which famous footballer I've met. And I also think it's good just to be able to switch off from politics for 90 minutes on a Saturday afternoon to have to concentrate on what's in front of you in the field of play and put some of the political debates to the back of your mind for a wee while. I think that's healthy.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I think I've seen you as a linesman a few times and I've seen you in the middle. What do you prefer doing? We'll start off with some football talk and we'll ease into the politics.
Yeah, well, this is what normally happens. We start off about football talk, and I like that. So I prefer being an assistant referee. I reached a level called specialist assistant referee. So at a point in my career, observers who came to watch me said I was quite good on the line. Not that they were saying I wasn't good in the middle, but I'll leave your listeners to decide that themselves. And indeed, I've had some interesting matches in the Forest and Nairn Welfare or the Moray Welfare that probably people are glad that I don't referee so much now. But I did referee in the Highland League and I enjoyed that. But becoming an assistant referee, I felt, gave me opportunities to progress to a higher level. And I did. You know, I now operate in the Premiership in Scotland. For a while, I was one of only 10 international assistant referees representing Scotland. I've done Champions League matches, Europa League, World Cup qualifiers. I did the Riyadh Derby in Saudi Arabia. So it gave me great opportunities. And again, you know, my political opponents criticise me for it. I personally think it's quite good that someone who was born and brought up in Moray, who started his refereeing career, as I say, in the local welfare matches and schools football around Moray, could reach the top of his game, both domestically and internationally, in a sport that I personally love.
Yeah, and it's a bit stressful being a ref at times. I think I had to cover just for a few, like a small girls tournament, I had to cover ref in that, and it's intense.
It is. And that's what I was saying. You know, I can't think about work for those 90 minutes because I have to be focused on what's in front of me. I've got to make sure that I don't miss an offside, that I don't miss a foul, that I work with the referee, the fourth official and the other assistants. So for me, it's good to be able to just concentrate so much on that. Yes, we get abuse. I probably get more abuse than most because people know me both as a politician and as a referee. But look, I'm used to it. I've got a thick enough skin to not be too upset by that, and I do. I just like getting out in the fresh air on a Saturday. It's pretty chilly at this time of year. As we were recording this, my game on Saturday was Ayr United v Arbroath, and the conditions were terrible. It was windy, it was wet, it was cold, but still, you know, I enjoy being involved in a game of football.
It's maybe not at this time of year though, when you're still shivering at the side. And for those who don't
I've been shivering in Murray in July as well. So you never know what kind of weather you're going to get.
Fair point. But yeah, for those who don't know, I coach football and we're going into the Forest and Welfare League. So this summer, I can't remember if it's this year or next year, one of the sides that I coach, but that'll be interesting.
Good. Well, enjoy that. And I hope the referees are of a good standard. They're all good friends and colleagues of mine in Murray and Banff and north of Scotland.
So do I. No, they're all nice enough people, the ones I've had so far.
Yeah.
Maybe not good enough refs, but nice enough people.
Well, yeah. But again, you know, part of the problem is, and I'm not saying this about you, Dominic, but a number of people watching football don't know the laws of the game.
Yeah.
And a lot of the criticisms people have about referees, assistant referees, is based on the fact that they don't actually know the laws that we're being asked to implement. And that goes for spectators, managers, coaches, and players. And even at the top level, professionals whose life it is to play football still don't know the laws of the game.
Yeah. I think there was someone on Sky Sports the other day, they have that ref watch thing, and it's so hard to watch.
Yeah.
Like, the ref knows what he's on about, he's qualified. But, oh well.
Yeah.
So we'll ease into the politics now. We've had a bit of more of a fun chat, I guess, there. Why are you a member of the Conservatives? What draws you to them?
So I personally believe in giving individuals and communities as much personal choice as possible. I want to see smaller government with more decisions taken locally. You know, I'd like to see devolution of powers. Yes, you know, we've seen power devolved from Westminster to Holyrood, but in our area of Murray, I sometimes think Edinburgh is as far away as London ever was before devolution. So my style of politics is smaller government, more devolution, more local decision making and accountability, and giving people as much opportunity to keep and spend their own money rather than government taking more and more taxes and dictating how that money should be spent.
That's pretty much how they position themselves, so that makes sense. And obviously, I'd like to say everyone's ideal world sounds great on both sides of the debate. So what makes you believe that the Conservatives' ideal is more realistic than, say, a left-wing ideal of everyone helping each other out, more government? Like, because obviously, they both sound good, but what makes yours more achievable?
Well, I suppose just with the idea of bigger government, I just think it's wrong to think that, you know, the 650 MPs or the 129 MSPs know what is best for their country at every opportunity. Surely people in Murray know what's best for Murray rather than people in Edinburgh or people in London. And this idea that there should be this top-down approach, I think just doesn't work, because a one-size-fits-all approach is never correct, and certainly not for an area like Scotland, which has got such diverse communities. You know, you go from extremely remote and rural areas to massive built-up urban cities, and we can't possibly have the same solutions to similar problems in those very different you know, areas of the country. And that's why I think, you know, more local accountability and more local decision making is the way to go.
I think that isn't a side that people argue with the Conservatives. That's a side that most would say, I can see why you believe that. So I'm happy with that. What about why are you still in the Conservatives? Because the past year has been a pretty hectic one. What has kept you there and not made you think maybe it's not the same party I wanted to join?
Well, first of all, you know, my relationship with Boris Johnson, for example, it was not great. And, you know, we disagreed significantly over the issue of Partygate. My view was, you know, you don't leave a political party because of the actions of one person who happens to be the leader at the time. You stay in that party to try and change things and improve things. And I think in Rishi Sunak, we have an excellent prime minister. I was delighted that his first visit to Scotland as prime minister was up to our area in the Highlands, up to Inverness, just last week, announcing massive investment to Cromarty, £52 million for two new freeports in Scotland backed by UK government funding that's taken tens of thousands of jobs both to Cromarty in the Highlands and also to Firth of Forth. So yes, you know, I have not shied away from the difficulties of the past year, but I still believe that the Conservative and Unionist Party is the best party to take our country forward both here in Scotland and across the UK.
Do you genuinely at this moment believe that, when's the next election, 2024?
So 2020
for Westminster.
Yes, 2024, because yeah. 5 years from 2019. Yeah.
Do you think the Conservatives have a realistic chance of winning?
Well, I think there's a absolutely a realistic chance, because, you know, I'm again not hiding from the polling numbers, but we're a long way out from an election. And the closer you get to an election, the more focused minds are. And at the moment, people may say, right, to an opinion pollster, OK, I'll vote Labour at the next election. But the closer they get to the election, they'll think, well, what do Labour stand for? What are Labour promising to do? And what are the Conservatives actually doing? And I think while Keir Starmer and Labour are, you know, having a pickup in the opinion polls, it's not backed by any significant policies. I haven't heard anything from Keir Starmer apart from backing the strikes that we've got across the UK just now. And I would seriously worry about how crippled our economy and our country would be if a Labour Prime Minister gets in and just basically plays to the tune of the unions who want to shut down the country. That's a really serious concern that many people have. For example, here in the House of Commons last night, we debated legislation on strikes and still allowing people in the emergency services and education to strike, to let their views be known, but to provide a minimum level of cover to ensure that if people need to use the emergency care in the NHS, that's available. And Labour voted against it. And I can't understand why you would vote against something which is already in operation across much of Europe. Many countries in Europe and across the world have this minimum standard of delivery during strikes. Labour voted against it, basically saying they're happy for people to go without medical care, education, for these strikes to continue. And I think that's quite a worrying message from the Labour Party.
I was going to lead on to strikes at some point anyway, but
okay.
While
well,
we're
I've
on
done
it,
it for you. Sorry about that.
Yeah, you've done the transition. It's fine. You can take my job, eh? But so personally, in general, I find myself normally backing strikes. There's been a fair few this year that I've not had the chance to look at because I've had a fairly busy year. But in general, I'll back a strike. So normally, so my reaction to a strike would be what has caused it. Instead of trying to limit to a minimum standard, which I understand the reasoning for, I would first try and look what are they asking for and is it reasonable. I think a pay rise, most of the strikes right now is like pay rise in line with inflation, roughly, most of them, right? This is a general statement, which I know you can't really do in politics, but roughly. Do you think that a pay rise in line with inflation is reasonable enough to strike? And do you understand why the strikers are striking?
Well, I understand why the strikers are striking, both in Scotland against decisions taken by the Scottish government and at a UK level against the UK government, and in Wales against the Welsh government. And these are three different governments represented by three different parties where strikes are happening. So for people to say these are strikes against Conservatives, that's wrong, because in Wales they're against Labour, and in Scotland these strikes are against the SNP. The issue with inflation is it will only continue to rise and get worse and get more out of control if more public money goes into paying these inflation kind of rated increases. And if we always increase wages by inflation. In the public sector, one, we know that's not happening for those working in the private sector, and two, inflation will just continue to rise. We need to get on top of inflation. That's the thing that's pushing up all the bills around the country. And if we can get on top of inflation, get it back down again, then the economy will be in a far more prosperous place. And that's what I want to see, growth in the economy, our economy doing better. And that helps everyone, because then the government are taking more money in taxation and revenue.
Which would be nice. How would you plan then on getting on top of inflation? Because the Conservatives have been in power, what is it, just over, I can't remember what year it is now.
Well, 12 and a bit years. Remember, the Conservatives have been in power as a Conservative majority government since 2019. Yeah. 2010 to 15 was the coalition government with the Liberal Democrats. 15 to 17 was a very small majority, but a majority. 17 then, Theresa May lost the majority, but the biggest party, so there was confidence in supply. And then from 19 onwards, a big 80-seat majority. So although we've been in power for a long time, a lot of that time has been with other parties or doing cooperation agreements, because there wasn't an overall majority. But in terms of getting on top of inflation, it's getting on top of public spending. And that's why there have been difficult decisions taken by the Chancellor, Jeremy Hunt, but we have seen some really positive movement in our economy. Indeed, the economy grew more than was expected in the last quarter, I think it was, the figures out earlier on this week. So there are already positive signs that the economy is reacting well to the decisions taken by Jeremy Hunt and Rishi Sunak in this government.
With the economy as it is, because as much as, yeah, there is short-term improvement, we're not in a great place as a country right now. Like, children are literally starving in 2022. What, given the fact that stuff like that is happening, people are sleeping on the streets in what is supposed to be a first world country, we're seeing cabinet ministers such as Suella Braverman and Priti Patel before her, focusing a lot more on, and I want to say it's more like what the tabloids want to hear, like concerning immigration, calling it stuff like an invasion. Do you not think, because immigrants have done a lot for this country, that can't be denied. Do you not think our attention should be more on, let's help people here and the people that are literally fleeing a war zone, which is a fair few of them, who are crossing the channel, which is quite a dangerous thing to do. And I actually think if they can do that, they can help us out somehow. Do you not think we should be trying to help people rather than scare them off? Because given the state of the country, people need help. They don't need fear. They don't need anger. They need help.
Well, there's a lot in that question. And yes, I absolutely believe we should be supporting the most vulnerable in society. And indeed, that's what Mel Stride, as the new Secretary of State for the Department of Work and Pensions, is doing. He's ensuring that there is good support there for people who find themselves out of employment, but also support to get people back into work, because that's one of the best ways to get people out of poverty, is to get people back into work, earning a good wage and supporting themselves and their families. In terms of immigration, again, we've got to separate different aspects here. People fleeing war and persecution absolutely deserve and do get a warm welcome here in the United Kingdom. If you look at the Afghan scheme, the Syria scheme, and those fleeing Ukraine, they were offered safe entry into the United Kingdom. People crossing the channel, first of all, are doing it illegally. They should not be crossing the channel. And it is a dangerous and treacherous journey. And it is one that claims far too many lives. And the bottom line is, they are not fleeing war, crossing from France to the United Kingdom. They are already in a European Union country, which has its own obligations to support refugees. And they have travelled some distance to get to France. Now, France is not at war with anyone. There is not a conflict currently going on in France. And there are support mechanisms in France to help people and to help refugees. And I think what we must do is deter people making that next journey from France to the United Kingdom, because the only people who benefit from that are the people traffickers that are charging tens of thousands of pounds to illegally take people over the channel. And sadly, many of the people that make that journey, who do want a better life in the United Kingdom, never make it here because they perish on the way across. Yet all along, these gangs and illegal traffickers financially benefit from it. And the last thing I would say on this is there are a significant number of people who make that crossing young men, young, able men who come to the United Kingdom, and we have to question why they're coming here when they are not directly fleeing a war zone. They're not a family or minors. They are people coming here for other reasons that is troubling for the government and for many communities that we represent.
So, like there was a lot in the question, there's a lot in the answer, because it was a big question. It's the people then that are crossing, some of them then, who aren't the people traffickers, the ones that are paying, are they not victims because they feel they have to? Are they not? Yeah, they're not victims if they're
They absolutely are victims, and they've left their home country, and that's a massive decision for them to leave their home country, and often they will be in fear, but they will also be in fear crossing the channel.
Oh yeah,
and unsure if they will actually make it to the UK coast or not. So why not do more to support them in France, to support the French government to deal with their asylum claims there, which is a safe country?
Trying to make it safer and more legal, I completely understand that. So because of that, we're seeing that makes sense. That viewpoint is a fair viewpoint to have, one that you can have reasoned debate with.
And that's what we had, obviously, with the Ukraine scheme.
Yeah.
You know, there was a war in Ukraine that no one wanted, and people had to get out as quickly as possible. So the government were able to get schemes up and running take women and families over here. And we've got Ukrainian families in Moray. I've met a number of them who come to Moray and have settled there, still desperate to get back home again. You know, they don't want to be in Scotland or the UK forever. They want to get back to a peaceful Ukraine. And again, everything the UK government's doing to support Ukraine will hopefully help them to get back to their country quicker as well.
Yep, and this is what this interview is about. It's about getting reasoned viewpoints. And because of that, do you think there's a few, I'm going to say it's a vote, it's a minority, they're very loud, that are using maybe what's the wrong language in this, calling it something like, a fair few people call it an invasion, and I feel like that is just, that doesn't help anyone, that's just causing a fight. Do you think the language around this issue needs to change? That's what the question was.
We've always got to be careful about the language we use, and sometimes, you know, I've used language in the past that in hindsight I wish I hadn't used, you know, so we've always got to reflect on what we say. However, you know, we don't experience up in Moray what my colleague down in Dover experiences on a daily basis. And I can imagine that the concerns in those coastal communities near the Channel crossing will have a different feeling about this than, you know, our community up in the northeast of Scotland.
Yeah. And I'll end that topic there for people, because I believe that's all. I'm just trying to learn people's viewpoints, which I've got that. And in the end, I'm not an immigrant, and I'm not in Moray, as you said, there's not really a massive percentage of immigrants here. So it isn't really my place to take a strong view on it just yet. Maybe if I moved down there or I was an immigrant, then sure. Yeah. But that was just so I could learn. So moving on to the Scottish Parliament now, we might circle back. It's just so we can try and get a bit of everything in. What is your biggest issue at the moment with the Scottish, with the SNP government? One singular issue.
Yeah, right now then, the one singular issue is their performance in Scotland's NHS. We have the worst A&E waiting times on record. We have the worst cancer treatment times on record. We have one in seven Scots, one in every seven people in Scotland is on a waiting list in Scotland's NHS. The SNP have been in charge, fully in charge of Scotland's NHS for more than a decade and a half, and they have to answer for the problems that they've created. Again, I don't want to get too local and parochial, but you know, you'll know Dr. Gray's Hospital very well. Between Christmas and New Year, there was eight ambulances stacked outside Dr. Gray's. That was almost every ambulance facility for our area was parked outside the hospital because they couldn't transfer the patients from the ambulance to the A&E ward because it was full. So these are having massive impacts on people's lives. I raised a case with the First Minister at FMQs last week about an 80-year-old who had a number of health problems. He'd had his hips replaced, he had heart problems, he had trouble breathing, and his family went to see him in Hogmanay and they found him on the floor having had a fall with a broken neck. They dialed 999 seven times and it took 12 and a half hours for an ambulance to reach a Scottish pensioner in his 80s with a broken neck. So the big issue I'm raising, and I think I'm right to raise at the moment, is performance in Scotland's NHS. In no way critical of the outstanding doctors, nurses and staff in our health system and our health service who do go above and beyond to deliver for people, but their hands are being tied by decisions of Hamza Yousaf, the health secretary in the Scottish government, who have not prepared the NHS for the winter crisis. And we are seeing the implications of that in terms of the level of service people are getting at the moment.
And I think anyone who would say that the NHS here is in a good place would be borderline deluded, but I think most people can accept that it isn't in a great place. What would make the Conservatives the best party to turn that around? Because from what I've heard from relatives that live in England, it's not that much better. It's still a bit better, to be fair, but not much better down south.
So we've issued last month in December, we had a series of individual measures that we wrote up in a booklet, a winter plan for Scotland's NHS that could have been implemented. Nicola Sturgeon and Hamza Yousaf could have said to my shadow health secretary, Sandish Gulhani, who's a practicing GP in Scotland, who understands the internal workings of the NHS, he could have said, right, Sandish and the Scottish Conservatives, you brought forward these ideas. We can see they would have an impact in terms of reducing the times people are waiting in hospital, getting more patients seen more quickly, dealing with all these issues. But the SNP chose to ignore it. The SNP decided to say, no, we're not interested in hearing other views. We think our way is the only way, and things are getting worse. So I really wish we could actually take some of the politics out of the NHS and the debate around the NHS and listen to views from the Conservatives and from other parties who are bringing forward ideas that could help patients, could help staff within the NHS and start to tackle these long waiting lists that we've got. But the SNP are unwilling to budge. And I have to say the Health Secretary has overseen failure after failure within the NHS. And I don't believe he can continue in post. I don't believe he has the confidence of the NHS and certainly not of many patients I speak to.
And this is probably where I would agree with the Conservatives, which, like I said, I'd probably at this moment be leaning more towards Labour, but I'm open to discussing and learning. Do you think there isn't enough people in politics, like in Holyrood, in Westminster, that are up for cooperation? So a lot of it seems like too many people are trying to play the game, trying to win rather than try to improve the country.
Yeah, I think the nature of politics means that those who ultimately get elected, either Holyrood or Westminster, are very party political individuals. You know, they believe they've worked through the ranks and they have, in my case, developed many policies as party leader that I'm very proud of and very committed to. And I want to see these policies improving the lives of people across Scotland. But there are opportunities at times to work together. And I think we should do more of that. For example, I'm currently taking forward the first party leader ever to take forward a private members bill in the Scottish Parliament, looking to address the shameful record we have for drug deaths in Scotland. Mm-hmm. The highest anywhere, not just in the United Kingdom, but in Europe. And at First Minister's questions more than a year ago, maybe 18 months, 2 years, 18 months ago at least, I invited Nicola Sturgeon to come on a joint visit with me. And it's the first time ever there had been a joint visit between the First Minister and the Leader of the Opposition in the Scottish Parliament. And I thought that was right. I thought it was right to work together on such an important issue. Now, there's not been the progress there that I was hoping for, but I hope that shows you and others that I'm very open to this collaborative working because, well, I think we've got some solutions as Scottish Conservatives. I don't pretend we have all the answers. And on issues like drug and alcohol deaths, on the future of our NHS, I think we should be listening to all sides to try and improve the system.
And I would like to take the conversation further, but I'm wary of the time. So I'll just try and wrap it up with a few shorter, simpler questions. Just
simpler
so
questions. I'm not sure there'll be simpler answers, but I'll try.
But yeah, you never know. I might get you back on again one day. I'll see if I can get like all four party leaders at once. That'd be interesting.
That would be certainly interesting, yeah.
But this is what I was thinking. What was Boris Johnson like behind the scenes? I don't mean like, did you like him or dislike him? Was it like the character he portrays himself as behind the scenes?
Yes, very, very much so. He was very jovial. He enjoyed a laugh and a joke, and that was his style. He relaxed people by being very informal and very, he liked a joke. He liked to lighten the atmosphere. That was his style.
Which is probably why he won the 2019 election. I'd say it's mostly down to the work he's done. And for some people, I think it was the personality they voted for and not the policies, because people have busy lives. They don't have time to read a full manifesto. So, you know, you've got to watch the leadership debates. I do urge people to read the full manifestos, though. Yeah. That would be helpful. This is one thing that I've been interested in. So Jeremy Corbyn was leader of Labour for a while, and he was vilified by some parts of the press and glorified by others, like it was a love or you hate him. There didn't seem to be much in between. What was he like behind the scenes?
I had zero dealings with Jeremy Corbyn. I was an MP from 17 to 19 when he was leader of the opposition. So I saw him at the dispatch box when I was in at Prime Minister's Questions, and he would walk past me sometimes, but we never shared a conversation. Yeah. My view is probably the same as the view that you would have reached. Maybe we came to a different conclusion, but I saw no more of him than you saw on the TV.
Okay, so yeah, do you think that was because you were separate parties and it's a little bit awkward, maybe?
No, I just think, you know, I was a Scottish MP. There was very little reason for me to have interaction with the UK leader of the Labour Party, a London MP who had wildly different political views than I did.
Yeah, no, fair enough. And what's your top of your bucket list? Politics, football aside, well, you can keep footballing. Politics aside, what is something you want to achieve before you're dead? That's a blunt way of putting it, but...
but not within politics?
Not within politics.
Oh, right, what do I want to achieve out with politics? Well, I want to, have more time to spend with my family. Sorry, that's a bit of a corny answer, maybe, but my wife is a police officer in Elgin, and we've got two wee boys. And I have to say, over the Christmas period, it was nice to be able to spend a lot more time with them. So it's not really a bucket list thing, but it's something that I strive to insert a bit more family time within my already quite hectic schedule.
Yeah, that's fair dues, to be fair. It's a good answer in it as well for people listening. It's not one that they can disagree with.
Well, particularly if my wife's listening, I thought I'd better add that in there.
Fair enough. And last one, what football club do you support, really quickly?
So we are not obviously allowed to support a football club because we are impartial as football officials.
Okay. So would you rather then Scotland final of the World Cup, right? Or win the Euros?
I think getting to the final of the World Cup would be pretty good, because if we could qualify for the World Cup, then we'd have a pretty good chance of qualifying again for the Euros. And I can't believe that we haven't qualified for a World Cup since I was at secondary school at Forest Academy. I still remember the first game, Scotland-Brazil in the 1998 World Cup, and thought this was great. We're the opening game of the World Cup, thinking, right, Euro 2000, that's the next one. And then, of course, we never qualified for Euro 2000. And the most recent qualification, it was when Steve McLaren got it into the most recent Euros. Yeah. So I hope to see Scotland in more major finals, because it was great to follow them in the Euros last year.
Cool. So yeah, that brings us up then. That's the time pretty much gone. Thanks for coming on the show. I think you've given pretty much answers to everything. I was warned about interviewing politicians, but I've got answers, so that's fine.
It's been great to join you, and I hope you get other politicians and other party leaders coming on. You know,
I'm working on it.
Yeah, but I think it's important that we are open and available to engage with people. And what you do through podcasts is one really important mechanism that we can get our views across. And your style is very good. You get good answers out of people, hopefully, because you've got a good style of interviewing people. So really appreciate that.
Cheers. I'm a bit rusty today, though. I've not done it in a while. But...
Oh, well. No, I thought you were very good. I enjoyed that.
Cheers.